Body, body, mind, spirit radio, your life connection to the information for a healthy body, an enlightened mind, and a renewed spirit.
Good afternoon. Today is August 11th, 2014, and it is 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and you're listening live with Body, Mind, Spirit Radio and In Touch Interviews. This afternoon, we actually have a wonderful guest here. And she is here to talk about her book, Birthing Death. Her name is Sue Fabian. And before I bring her live, I would actually like to give you a little bit of a background information about her. She had humble beginnings and deep challenges forged this 22 and 27-day caregiver in the working town area of Southeast Michigan. She was born into a working-class family where her father had an eighth-grade education and her mother was fortunate enough to graduate from high school. Her maternal grandparents were equally from meager backgrounds. Her grandmother had an eighth-grade education, her grandfather, third grade. Chores were stressed over education in their farming families in rural Wisconsin. Her paternal grandparents of unknown educational background immigrated from Croatia's Istrian Peninsula. Tragedy struck early when Sue's father died at the age of 48 years of cancer, leaving a young mother and three children from ages 9 to 16. Sue was the youngest. Education was never stressed for Sue. That was only for her two older brothers. Yet she managed to be the first female in her ancestral pedigree to complete college, graduating cum laude and departmental honors with a Bachelor of Psychology from Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan in 1976. She went on to earn a Master of Education with specialization in guidance and counseling from the University of Windsor, Ontario, Canada in 1980 and gained licensed professional counselor status in Michigan. During this time, she worked for Focus Hope, a civil and human rights organization born out of the ashes of Detroit's 1967 riots, and helped launch the nation's first supplemental food program for Detroit area seniors, who otherwise were perpetually faced with the economic choice of buying food or medication. She is a wonderful person with a lot of information to give for you guys today. And I'm so excited to have her here, the author of Birthing Death. Welcome, Sue.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, we're glad to have you here.
All right.
So you are the author of Birthing Death. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about the book and why you decided to write it?
Yeah. In October of 2012, my mom passed, ending a 22-year and 27-day saga of soul caregiving. In August of 2013, I was getting restless, and I really didn't understand why. And so although I don't normally journal to help manage my feelings, I have other ways of, you know, that usually work better for me. But it just came to me to start journaling, and I did. And the more I wrote, the more I wrote. And it dawned on me that what was happening was that I was a few months from the first year anniversary of my mom's passing. And as I continued to write about the reflections that I had, it just occurred to me that I needed to write a book and get all the experiences and knowledge that I have, not only about this personal experience, but about all the clients I've worked with over the years in my capacity as either an elder law attorney or a geriatric care manager. I needed to get it out of my head and onto pages that would survive me to benefit other people that were about to enter this kind of journey. And I never intended to write the book. It just sort of evolved, and that's how it happened.
Wow. Now, you know, it's actually a curious title, Birthing Death. Most people don't think of death that way. What does that mean for you, and why did you choose that title?
That's really the essence of the experience that I went through in the 27-day inpatient hospice ward watching my mom die. When there's nothing left to do, there's no more medical tricks to try, there's no more alternative medicine tactics to try, there's no more nothing. I mean, there's absolutely nothing to do. And this is a time when family members witnessing the dying of their loved one feel utterly futile. And it occurred to me in these moments that that was precisely the time that I was being called upon to do my most important work with my mom. And from my point of view, and in my way of believing about myself in relation to the world and the world beyond, I just felt so strongly that I needed to be as present as I could be to help birth my mom's soul into the great mystery as her body was dying. And that's how the title came out. It was very, usually people can spend agonizing moments figuring out a title to their book. This one was so manifestly clear to me because that is the essence of the dying process between the dying person and the family member, in my view. That's how I came up with the title.
Now, you wrote the book from a couple different perspectives. You actually talked a lot about, actual genuine medical care, which when somebody passes, they do need, like hospice. You also talked a little bit about spiritual, and how somebody dies, how that can be spiritual. But you also covered another element, and I can't think of it off the top of my head.
Well, there's patient advocacy, there's family discord, there is the spiritual aspect of this whole event, and then the emotional roller coaster of the primary caregiver. So those are the four main areas that I covered in the book.
Yes, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, because when somebody passes, a lot of people always make that assumption of, well, we just have to do the legal stuff. We have to bury them, cremate them, get rid of their stuff. A lot of people tend to have that legal and patient advocacy more than, the spiritual, the family dynamics, or the emotional. Why are all four of those very important?
Well, the patient advocacy actually comes in during the dying process, not entirely after death. And I want to give you a for instance. Prior to putting my mom in the hospital-based hospice, she was in an assisted living facility under hospice care. Now, in July of 2012, I engaged hospice for a third round. My mom graduated from the first two rounds. And by the way, I'm very aggressive about employing hospice. There had been a stretch, for instance, where my mother had been in the hospital twice within a 6-7 month period. Once I brought hospice on board the first time, she went 18 months before any episode. So it's not, you're not throwing in the towel when you hire a hospice service. Oftentimes it's putting in a whole additional level of care at no cost that can head problems off at the pass. So I am not a believer in hospice just for the last few days or couple of weeks. I had my mom on hospice for a total of nearly 2 years, all told. But by this last hospice round, stint number three started in July. July and August were status quo. She was stable. And by the end of August, I knew, by virtue of what I do for a living, that the 90-day recertification decision would be coming up in a few weeks. We had already passed day 60. And I knew by the end of September they would decide. And so I started talking to them about what were they going to do. What they saw was a stable patient. That's what all their numbers told them, all the ways they measure a person's health status. But I knew, and I can't really break this down for you. I just knew. It's a very intangible feeling that she would be not served at all if they were going to decide to discharge her from hospice care. And come to find out, because of my preemptive questioning, not just sitting around and waiting for them to make a decision, and hence a point of patient advocacy here, I knew that recertification decision was coming up. I started talking to them and found out that, in fact, all team members thought she should be discharged. So I started my campaign because I knew it would not serve her to take her off of hospice at this point. Any little thing would upset the apple cart. She was approaching age 91. She was subject to reoccurring infections. She had congestive heart failure. She had diabetes. She was wheelchair-bound from a hip fracture, and there's a few other conditions that she had. Any little thing could cause a nosedive. And so I talked to every team member, and I campaigned hard. Finally, they reversed course and decided to recertify her at, this would be about mid-September. By October 30th, my mom died. Now, the point of that whole thing is, imagine the caregiver's experience had hospice, in fact, discharged her from their care, and I had nothing to turn to when she took her nosedive at the beginning of October. It was night and day. One day she was fine, the next day she was deathly ill. Imagine what my my path would have looked like after 22 years. I'm exhausted. I've gone through many points of crisis with her. My reserves are less and less. I have next to nothing left in my tank. Had I had to face her eventual decline without hospice, it would have been all that much harder. Because of my preemptive lobbying, because I knew that decision was coming up, and indeed I found out they were going to discharge her, it gave me a chance to fight the discharge. Another point to be made out of that is you don't have to just take their word for it. These decisions are appealable. Many people say, well, you know, that's the decision. I guess we have to live by it. That's not true. You don't have to be mean. You don't have to be nasty. But if you feel in your heart that it's not right, you have the right to appeal it. So I did, before the fact. I appealed it before the fact, before the decision had been made, or finalized, I should say. At any rate, she stayed on hospice. That's episode number one of patient advocacy before death. Episode number two. So now she takes her nosedive in early October. I escalate hospice care, and she continues to get worse. One evening, she's still in assisted living. My brother came there from after work when I had been there all day. About an hour later, he calls and says, Sue, Mom is totally unresponsive. Now, believe me, she looked awful even under the best of circumstances, but she was not unresponsive. So I raced up there, and because I know her history, and because I know what I know by virtue of what I do, I took one look at her, I checked her blood sugar, it had plummeted to 65. She hadn't eaten for 2 days because she was so sick. That alone drives down blood sugar. But to make matters worse, and here's the point of advocacy, the hospice nurse and the nurse site manager at the hospice facility were not coordinating care. I had seen them talk, so I assumed they were coordinating care of her. Well, the hospice nurse did not know that my mom hadn't eaten in 2 days. And so what happened is the site manager nurse continued to administer diabetic medication to my mom, which also drives down blood sugar. I only figured that out by unraveling the facts. I backtracked and asked, what is going on? What medications is she on? Then I learned she was still on Micronace. Well, you don't eat for 2 days and you get Micronace, your blood sugar is going to plummet. I held her near comatose head in my arm, praying with all my might that she could hear me enough to to follow the command to swallow the packet of sugar I was putting in her mouth. Had she not been able to do that, I was faced with this dreadful decision of whether to let her die in my arms or take her to the hospital, which she absolutely did not want anymore. It was a horrible point. That moment never should have happened. I only knew that because of what I do. Any unsuspecting family member would have just thought, she wouldn't have made it that night without my intervention, by the way. She would have died. Any unsuspecting family member would have concluded, well, I guess it was her time. Now, I could take my mom dying, but I couldn't take it due to a medical mistake. And this was sheer incompetence not to communicate to each other. And it happens all the time. That's patient advocacy point number two. To answer your question, patient advocacy occurs well before the death and in the dying process itself. My last point on this note is only to say, what difference did it make that I saved her life? And by the way, I have no medical training. That I saved her life that night when she was going to die anyway. Well, as said, I couldn't take her dying to a medical mistake. Number two, it allowed my brother from Colorado to fly in and say his goodbyes, which was extremely important to both of them. So there's so much to know, and there's so much to do before the death to ensure good care. And that's a lot of what I write about in the book.
I think that's amazing, especially because it's kind of interesting. I was talking to somebody the other day, and her father is very, very ill with prostate cancer. And they actually just brought in hospice, and they said that he has about 6 months, and they've been keeping him drugged up every day. They've been giving him large doses of morphine and oxycodone. And the girl that I spoke to is the daughter, and she told me that she felt like the drugs were just too much. You know, there's no reason to keep him dosed up. He's not complaining about high levels of pain or anything like that, and that because of the drugs, he won't get up out of the bed, he won't walk, he won't do anything. And I told her, I said, well, it's your decision what happens. You know, it's your guys' decision. Why are you allowing these medical professionals to literally, you know, keep your father comatose until he passes? You know, you guys need to put your foot down and advocate for him. You know, you guys are the voice of reason right now. And she goes, I never looked at it like that. She goes, I thought that we just had to listen to what the doctors say. And I'm like, who knows him best, a doctor or his family? So I think you bring up a very strong point of, you know, patient advocacy very much more before they pass away, because, you know, if the family doesn't do it, then who is going to do it?
Well, what you can also pass on to this contact of yours is for that individual to request what's called a case conference with the hospice personnel and state her concerns about the medication. It is a case conference where all of the main players in her father's care are brought to the table at the same time. It involves the nurse, the social worker. I would include the chaplain, if there's a primary aide assigned to that person. You can bring them all at the table at the same time and say, this is what I see, and it doesn't make sense to me. Please explain to me if you have a medical basis for doing what you're doing. Otherwise, if it's just to keep him in your mind comfortable, I know my dad far more than all of you put together, and here's what I know, and so what's happening just doesn't make sense. She needs to do that.
Well, I will definitely pass that information on to her. I greatly appreciate it, and I know she will too. The other three topics that you talk about in your book, one of them is family dynamics. Would you like to talk a little bit about that and how you talk about that in your book, especially because of, you know, the family discord, the arguing, you know, the unsettlement? It's a lot to take in. So would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. This experience of going through this final journey with your loved one is obviously agonizing to all family members. We all process in different ways, even from the same family, in the same set of parents and the same set of experiences. We all are unique people, and most people have a unique grieving process because of their own life experiences. Add to that the intensity of the moment, and that the primary caregiver, who's by the dying person's side most of the time and has much more subtle understanding of the circumstances and the wishes of that of the dying person, and then the long distance person who isn't in contact from the day-to-day basis, and that changes the perception that he or she might have of what is necessary in this care. So here we are, and by the way, there was a third episode of incompetent care of hospice at the assisted living facility, at which time I decided I couldn't continue to watch my mom in this grueling experience and babysit the medical profession. There are good hospices out there, but this one did not do the job at that moment. I pulled her out of assisted living, I took her to the hospital, and had her admitted to inpatient hospice. And some hospitals have a dedicated hospice ward. That's where I put her. In the hospital hospice setting, one of my two brothers wanted one thing, which was clearly, in my mind, based on walking by my mother's side virtually daily for 22 years, clearly inconsistent with her wishes. And so my two brothers debated the issue, and I am the legally appointed patient advocate. I sat there and listened to them debate, and it was excruciating. They went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. One was for blood transfusion, the other was against. And they were... they're both engineers. I love them both. I care about them both. But they come from a background that is very different than mine. I come from a counseling background, more of a humanistic background. And I couldn't digest the way they were debating this so matter-of-factly. And an uncontrollable wave of emotion just came out of me, and I uncorked. And I was being as real as I could be. I wasn't trying to tamp any of it down. I wasn't trying to be mean. I was saying what I knew in my heart to be true. And boy, did it come out. And I just voiced the wishes on behalf of my mom so strongly that the nurses were ready to call the security. They thought we were in there, you know, really having it out. Well, we never did get physical. Neither of us would do that. It's not our way of doing it. But I did get very vocal, and from there, we had to somehow get ourselves together to be there for our mom. Now, how in the world do you take that quantum leap from this complete explosion to coming back together and doing the most important work of being there for your dying loved one? And I write about that in the book. I will say briefly that instrumental in the process was engaging a professional within the hospital that a lot of people never think about, and that's the hospital chaplain. And she came in, she worked with me, and then she started her shuttling between me and my brother, acting as liaison and negotiator between us two, until we each were steady enough on our feet and with our own feelings that we could engage each other directly again and then go on and do the more important work of being present to my mother. But it was just a dreadful experience for both of us. I'm thankful that even with our differences, we have a fundamental basis of love between us, and that's between that and the work of the hospital chaplain. That's how we were able to navigate through the reconciliation process to go back into my mom's room and be with her. So that's what I write about when I suggest that one huge aspect of the book is dealing with the family discord. The emotional roller coaster of the primary caregiver, that would be me. Unless you've been through this experience with someone that's core in your heart, it is nearly impossible to describe, under the best of circumstances, what it is like watching your loved one die. I've been to a lot of funerals. I've seen a lot of people in my life at the end of life because I deal with older adults at the end of life. But until it hits your personal world, it's an entirely different phenomenon. So I'm in the room with her, and she begins to, her breathing begins to be very uneven in long pauses between breaths. And on every long pause, I would catch my breath, and I'd think, oh, my God, is this it? Is this the last one? Does she want me to be here? Does she want to be alone? Do I get the other people out of the room? Here's another long breath. Is this it? And the intensity is just as high as it can get every moment. And that lasted for 27 days. It's impossible to try and relay what that experience is like. And then the day after I got her into the hospital, she rallied. You often hear about people in hospice. When they're at death's door, they have this sudden rally. And the day after she entered the hospital, it was like mom again. Her presence was clear. She was smiling. As horribly sick as she was, she still had that smile. And my Denver brother had a chance to spend the whole day with her watching Tiger baseball, who were in the playoffs at that time, and that was my mom's favorite thing. So he had a spectacular day with her when she rallied, and then she went downhill again. And so every little twist and turn, you wonder, well, is this just a big, bad bump in the road? Is she going to come back? And if she comes back, what's she going to be like? Is she going to be unresponsive for a long time, and now I got to think about putting her in a nursing home? Is she going to die? Should I start making the funeral arrangements? The decision-making that goes on in your head, it goes on many different tracks simultaneously in addition to all the emotions you're going through. So I also write a lot about that in the book, and I give a lot of what I call tool bag thoughts to help navigate that insanity, that just craziness that you go through at a time like that. So that's what I allude to when I also reference the emotional roller coaster of the primary caregiver.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about tool bag tips and so forth. Would you like to give an example of a few of those?
Yeah. At the end of each chapter, I have a box of questions and suggestions. And for instance, as to family discord that might surface, I ask, can you find a way to keep talking through a decision if a family member agrees? you have to keep the dialogue going. Somehow, you have to keep the dialogue going. Or are you able to set limits when another's request stretches you too thin, even if it's your dying loved one's request? For instance, there was one night when my mom was, after her rally, she began to fade again, and it was that night when she wanted me to sleep in the hospital by her bedside. I was so exhausted, and for me, if I don't get a decent night's sleep, it's like pulling the plug out. I'm just like a zombie walking. And I tried. I stayed for about an hour and a half, and if you've ever tried to spend the night in the hospital, it is no place to find rest because there's nurses walking up and down the hall. There's people entering the room, checking on the patient. There's monitors going off in other people's rooms, et cetera, et cetera. And I so desperately needed sleep during this emotionally intense period. I finally got up after an hour and a half. It had to be about 1 a.m. And I said to my mom, I said, I just can't do it. I have to go home and get some sleep. I'll be back in the morning. If you didn't think that was hard, but I had to set a limit or I would be no good to her or anybody. Ironically, there's a huge side note to that story that confirmed the rightness of that decision for me in that moment. I walked down to the hospital lobby, and because it was late at night, I wanted a security escort back to the parking garage. I waited about 15 minutes, and I was so tired I couldn't wait anymore. So I got up, and just at the moment I got up, the security car pulled up. And I entered, and I told him what parking garage I was in. And then I just briefly told him what was happening. And I told him that my mother is dying. She will die shortly. He told me the most amazing story of all the chances of running into this guy at 1 a.m. on this particular night are astronomical. He said, I want you to know that your mom is headed for a good place. And, you know, I didn't know how to take him. Is this going to be a holy roller sort of thing or what? He said, I want you to know that I died. And I was blown away. He said, as a teenager, I can't remember the specifics, if it was a diving accident or whatever, but he said he had died and he had had a near-death experience. And he knew what my mom's destination was. To get that kind of confirmation at that moment was just breathless. It was astonishing. So I don't know where to take it from here, but that was the, it was setting limits is the main point. You have to know when you set your limit. And I said no to my mom, even though she was dying. That is awful hard to do.
I think one of my favorite portions that I read in the book was, and it was one of the toolkit tips or thoughts, was that you need to have a space or someplace that you can actually go to separate yourself. When somebody is dying and somebody is in their last, you know, minutes, days, hours, a lot of people crowd around that person. You know, they have to be with them constantly and consistently, and you can't leave their side, and what if this is the last minute, and you know, what if this is the last breath, kind of like what you said. But I thought it was nice that you recommend that in the book, you know, to have a place to go, to have a spot to go to gather your thoughts, to come back together, to have a sense of peace while going through this transition.
The waiting room in a hospice ward is like no other. You know that every person walking through that, you know what they're going through. You don't know the details. You haven't walked their path in life, but at that moment, they too are losing someone they dearly love. And so we all look at each other in silence with this fundamental understanding. Just that affirmation. When no one's saying anything, But we all know just that camaraderie, that silent camaraderie itself is respite for the weary caregiver at this point. You have to have those spaces. As for those that feel guilty that they were not at their loved one's side when the dying loved one took his or her last breath, I would say to those people, perhaps that's precisely what your loved one wanted, that they wanted to go out on their own terms without anybody present. In our case, someone was with my mom most of the time, but I also was mindful that perhaps she wanted to go out on her own. I didn't know. You can't know. But I gave her opportunities. And so we would all break periodically throughout the day. And every time I'd walk back in that room, I'd wonder, did she go or is she still with us? What in fact happened was our pattern was I would go there during the day. My one brother would come in after work and stay there for a couple hours. I would come back a little bit during that time, but I could come in and out because I knew my one brother was there. Then my Denver brother would come in at about 9 p.m. and stay there till about midnight, which he did on what turned out to be her last night. Minutes after he left, my mom drew her last breath. And I know that because it was his pattern to stay there until that time. And I got the call about 12:30 a.m. that night by the hospice nurse. And she said, I want you to know that as I had my mom's favorite church hymns playing in the background because she loved that music. She went out, the nurse said, on the crescendo of how great thou art. And that's the term she wanted to go out on. So I want to repeat that for those that may feel guilty about not being there, in retrospect, as they look back on this circumstance and they carry that guilt with them now, or for those who may be in this situation right now, it is important to consider whether your loved one wants to go out with or without you. And in my mind, give them opportunities either way.
Mm-hmm. You cover so much in your book.
Yeah.
And I think that it's all amazing. One of the elements you did talk about in the book was spiritual tasks. Now, we do have a caller on the line who wanted me to ask you this question. She wanted to know that if you believe that after someone has passed away, that they are still spiritually with you.
Well, as you know, having read the book, I spend a lot of time on that. I became consumed after my mom's passing over. Where is she? What is it like? What does she see? Who is she talking to? What does she experience? I just became consumed in it. I was so curious. And this was part of my grieving process, to become curious about that, when many other people wouldn't even think about that. I did. I mean, that's who I am. I don't know why, but that's how I processed. It is my belief that when one passes, they are much more than a mere memory and the tangible things you might have from their life, like a piece of clothing or old glasses or something they wrote. To me, they continue to be present. It's in what I can only best describe as a parallel universe. I have had a couple of mystical experiences in my life. I am not psychic. I don't have ESP, at least it's not developed. I guess we all have it, but for most of us it's latent. I wasn't gifted with any of those powers, but I have had a couple of mystical experiences where I just kind of pierced through the veil of life and had experiences of my father from the other side. He died 1964, 50 years ago, in fact. August 7th was the 50th anniversary of his passing. When my father died, it was like he disappeared and he's no more. When my mom died 50 years later, 48 years later, actually, it was a very different experience. I know that her presence continues, and I know that she knows what's happening in my life and in the life of all her kids and all those she cares about. That's my experience. It's more than a mental belief. It's a knowing of the heart, which is much more difficult to articulate. But let me add this thought. One of the talents my oldest brother has is the ability to engage people in conversation. And so when he was up there on the hospice ward from 9 to midnight every day, he talked to the hospice nurses about their experiences working on the hospice ward. And incredibly, one of the things they shared was that it was not at all that uncommon for two patients to die at exactly the same time. It was as though their spirits were in contact with each other and decided to hold hands and dive into the next life. They obviously had no physical way of knowing of even the existence of the other person, being in a separate bed in a separate room down the hallway. The hospice nurses also added that it is not at all uncommon to see shadows of presences in the hallway, those of the patients leaving this earth. Now, you know, this comes from a collection of hospice nurses, that this is their experience. There's also, obviously, a lot of books written on this subject, many of which I include in the reference section of the book. So, yeah, to directly respond to your caller's question, I feel so strongly that a person just doesn't stop to exist. Their body falls away, but their spirit, their essence continues.
Well, I want to thank you very much for answering that. I greatly appreciate it, and I know that caller does as well. I do see that we're starting to get a little bit low on time. I wanted to know if you would like to talk about your elder law practice.
Okay. I'm kind of the oddball in elder law. I say that because most elder law attorneys come from an estate planning background. I don't. And when I say estate planning, I mean doing estates for people that have a lot of money. I mean, that's where the money is. I do estate planning, but usually it's for people of modest means, you know, the typical middle-class person. But I came at it from, I have a very meandering course in my life. I never knew what I wanted to do when I grew up. I ended up going to law school when I was 40 years of age. And I knew from day one that I wanted to do elder law. I had worked with elders in many capacities in my life. That seemed to be a common thread. So I knew I wanted to do elder law. But prior to that, I had earned a counseling degree, a master's in counseling, and was doing counseling work. I ended up giving that up and turning to law, knowing that I wanted to help older adults. That's all I ever wanted to do. And I will tell you, elder law is not the most lucrative area of law unless you get into a lot of litigation or very high-end Medicaid planning, neither of which I do, by the way. But I do your basic estate planning with wills and trusts and powers of attorney. I've done a fair amount of probate work in guardianships and decedents' estates. I've done a fair amount with helping people apply for and become eligible for Medicaid in ways that are by the book. Of the Medicaid agency. That is, Medicaid's administered by the Department of Human Services in Michigan. We call it DHS for short. And it's by their book, so there's nothing untoward about that. I engage in Medicare advocacy. For instance, when I challenge the discharge of the hospice, that's a Medicare advocacy issue. I've been involved in a lot of long-term care situations where there are problems at the nursing home or an assisted living facility. I help families negotiate that. I've done some very end-of-life legal transactions, going to hospitals and nursing homes, getting the legal work done that could have and should have been done a whole lot earlier, but I'll tell you, 95 people out of 100 that knock on my door are in crisis. There's very little pre-planning. It's like doing your taxes. You know, you don't do it until the last minute. Who wants to do that? And legal planning has a lot of similarity in that regard. As a geriatric care manager, I've helped families in crisis care planning. For instance, mom or dad lives alone. They've had a stroke. What do we do? Which nursing home is best to rehab in? How do you even evaluate a rehabilitation program? And by the way, how do you evaluate a hospice program? Most people go to the hospice that they have been referred to. I am now a believer that not all hospices are the same. They can be very, very different, and I've come up with a checklist of sorts on how to evaluate a hospice service. So that's a very broad brush of what I do as both an attorney, an elder law attorney, a geriatric care manager, and an author. There's a lot to know. I am such a firm believer in patient advocacy. And understand that most people take on this role without a shred of training. None. There's no education out there for it. And yet they've got someone's life in their hands. So I give a lot of workshops on patient advocacy out in the public. So that's in a nutshell what I do and why I do it. I've lived this road. I have a very good understanding of what caregivers go through and what families go through, and that's why I do what I do. It's all my mom's doing.
I think that if she could speak to you right now, she would definitely say she's proud of you, because you do a lot, and the thing is it's got to be hard to help people who are, you know, going through that process of losing someone or needing help with that. I mean, that has to be emotionally taxing for you, too.
Well, it's an interesting comment, actually. It's not so much. At times it is. And like everybody else, at times I kind of roll my eyes and wonder, why am I doing this? But for the most part, I know what I do is important. It's meaningful. It helps people. It makes this world a better place for me, having lived in it, which is so important to me. But because I've lived this, and I've lived it for so long, going through so much, when someone comes in crisis, I don't know how to explain this. It really doesn't rattle me because I've been there. I don't know if that is clear or makes sense to you, but that's been my experience.
It does make sense, and I'm glad that you pointed it out and you answered that question that way, because, I think it's amazing what you do, and you're helping people, and you are making a difference. You know, I can relate to everything that you're talking about, because I've buried a lot of people in my life, including my father. I buried my father at 16.
Mm-hmm.
So I know what it is to lose and go through this process, and, you know, of emotional and family dynamics and patient advocacy and all of this. I think that the work that you're doing is amazing and very helpful, because I know that when I've been in that position to lose someone, I would have loved to have you there.
Well, thank you.
These are your options. These are what you can do, and maybe you need to step up a little bit more, or you know, to have somebody there to help you along that way. I think that's utterly amazing. One of the things that I loved that you talked a little bit of about, and like I said, I know we're getting a little short on time, but I wanted to talk about this real quick, is how to read a medical chart during, not after, discharge.
Well, a patient advocate has a right to see the patient chart. Now, they're not physical charts anymore. They're more and more electronic records. So that's you literally have to sit down at a computer to review a chart now. But what most hospitals will say is, well, we're happy to give you a copy after discharge. And I would look at the nurse and I would say, well, it doesn't do me any good after discharge. I have to make decisions now. I'd like to see the chart now. In one case, in one hospitalization, the nurse said, well, we can't do that. And I said, yes, you can. She said, no, you can't. It's against policy. So she said, you have to talk to a doctor. Day two rolls around, and two residents walk in my mom's room. I said, well, you're doctors. I want to see the chart. They said, no, you can't. I said, yes, I can. They said, no, you can't. You have to view it with the attending physician. Now, mind you, the attending physician is the quarterback of the hospital team. That attending is not going to have time to sit down for an hour as you go through the chart. And I knew that, but I didn't have the energy to fight it at that point. Day three rolls around. I ask the attending, and he said what I knew he was going to say. I can't get down there for another 3 hours, but I'll try and get down there. Well, 3 hours later, he called, and he said what I knew he would say. I can't do it. I don't have the time. Well, now I'm sufficiently flaming. And I march myself right into the chief legal officer's office of the hospital. And I said, I know what HIPAA is about, the federal privacy law. I'm an attorney. And I know, as a patient advocate, that I have a right to see that chart. He said, you're absolutely right. Go down there and ask for a nurse to review it with you, which is where I started 3 days ago. And you would think that finally broke the ice or parted the Red Sea, whatever metaphor you would like to use. But then shifts change. And I went through the same thing again. So I just started pulling out the chief legal officer's business card, and I said, call him. He knows it's okay. And those are the patient advocacy episodes you go through, because the medical charts are treated like Fort Knox, and in some ways rightfully so, but the patient advocate has a right to see them. And invariably, as well as I knew my mom, there was always something in the chart that I learned about her that neither the medical people thought to say or I thought to ask. So that's a very good ending question.
Well, I'm glad that you brought that up, and I'm glad that you had the opportunity to talk about that. We just have a few minutes left, so I was wondering if is there anything you would like to leave us with today, and how can we connect to you or how can our listeners connect to you and purchase their own copy of Birthing Death or ask you any further questions or anything along those lines?
Well, the book is on Amazon, first of all. You can go on Amazon Books and enter into the search code Birthing Death, and it'll pop right up. So that's the easy way to do it. If they're local and they want to pick up a book from me, they should call me. My work number is 248-585-7917. If callers have subsequent questions that they want to ask and they're more comfortable with email, they can email me at my work email, which is Sue@ElderwiseAdvisor.com. That's Sue@ElderwiseAdvisor.com. And I would say that in many issues affecting the elderly, especially legal issues, don't hesitate to call an elder law attorney, whether it be me or anyone else in the phone book. an hour of their time is well spent. When I first went through this with my mom, when she had a massive stroke in 1990, I was neither an elder law attorney nor a geriatric care manager. I was starting from the same position as all your callers. And I stumbled through it. And that's what motivated me to go to law school. I didn't want others to have to reinvent this wheel. An hour with me or an elder law attorney will save you a lot of time. And an hour with a geriatric care manager will save you a lot of time and misery of trying to reinvent the wheel. So that would be my parting comment.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, and thank you so much for being here to talk about your book. I definitely highly recommend that if you are going through any of these types of experiences, or even if you've went through one of these experiences, definitely pick this up and read it. To be honest with you, Sue, I'm actually going to go out and visit my grandparents in a couple of weeks. I have some vacation time, and my grandmother has buried so many people in the last 4 years. She's buried my great-grandmother. Her sister died last year of stage 4 breast cancer. We just lost my great-grandfather and my great-uncle around my birthday last year. So I'm actually going to give your book to her because I feel like it will really help her. So I want to thank you very much.
Well, that's a real compliment. I thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
All right. Take care.
You too. If you're listening live with us, today is August 11th, 2014, and you're listening live with Body, Mind, Spirit Radio and In Touch Interviews. We were just interviewing Sue Fabian, author of Birthing Death. She's given a lot of wonderful information and shared a lot of wonderful things with us today. So I highly recommend that you pick up her book. You can also find more information about it on Amazon, or you can actually go to elderwiseadvisor.com. I want to wish everybody a great and wonderful day. Please stay dry, and thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.